Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. You'll find all the TWiT shows on your Roku box, Android, and BlackBerry phones, and all Yahoo Widget TVs powered by MediaFly. For more information, visit twit.tv/MediaFly. This is TWiG, This Week in Google, episode 64, recorded October 13th, 2010. Men hold it this way. This Week in Google is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off the lifetime of your new account, go to squarespace.com/TWiG and use the offer code TWIG. And by MailRoute.info. MailRoute is a secure, hosted service that provides enterprise-grade virus and spam filtering to companies of any size. Find out more and get 10% off the life of your account at MailRoute.info. It's time for TWiG, This Week in Google, and today it's actually going to be This Week in Facebook and Microsoft as well. Anything that happens in the cloud, we talk about it here. And unfortunately, I have some very sad news. Gina Trapani's on vacation. She's actually, like, literally not going online during this vacation, but she has nominated in her place, I'm very glad to have her, the wonderful Jennifer Van Grove from Mashable.com, Jay Bruin on Twitter. Hi, Jennifer.
Hello.
Former San Diegan, but now San Franciscan. Good to have you also with us, as usual, Mr. Jeff Jarvis from the City University of New York, where he teaches journalism. You may remember him as a TV reviewer for, was it Us Magazine or Entertainment? I can never
remember. How dare you? People Magazine and Entertainment Weekly.
Entertainment Weekly and People Magazine.
You got a memory, Lee. I don't know. It's amazing.
I love those trash magazines.
Well, it's TV. Yeah.
I love TV. Also, glad to have you. He's the author of the book, which gives him great credibility, What Would Google Do? And we never know what Google will do next, but if you wanted to know, you would read that book. And finally, last but not least, and his forehead is not scarred. It just looks like it is. Robert Scoble, who apparently has burned out. Robert, you just did the laser thing.
Yeah.
You burned out more pixels.
Did I really?
Yeah. Now,
awesome.
Now it's not just your forehead, it's your cheek.
You got to see if you can burn out the rest of it.
No. Is that a red laser?
It's a purple one.
Purple. It's pretty.
Purple one from Warn Laser.
The ones that are illegal are the green ones, right?
Yeah, because they're very bright, and the human eye sees green very well. And so the light scatters off the atmosphere, and pilots really don't like seeing those things aimed at their eyes.
Right. That's why the WAS, of course, uses nothing but green lasers.
Yeah.
Which I will take this advantage of that to mention that WAS will be joining us in a couple of hours. We're going to start a feature interview show right after our Tech News Today show with Tom Merritt. Tom and I will interview big names next week. John Perry Barlow, one of the founders of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, but this week WAS.
John was a lyricist on the Grateful Dead as well.
Yes, he was. Too. Do me a favor with him. I know he gets a little bit embarrassed about it, but have him do a partial dramatic reading of his Declaration of Independence for cyberspace.
I will absolutely. Thank you, Jeff, for reminding me. It's such a seminal document. I know you did your own version of it on your blog,
but it's just great.
Yeah,
it's over the top, but I don't care. Have him do it over the top.
A dramatic reading would be fun. Has he ever done that before?
I don't know that he has. He really should.
He's got a great voice too. It'd be really good. All right, deal. Remind me, Eileen. Dramatic reading. Internet Bill of Rights. So WAS is coming up. If you have questions for WAS, we're still taking them via Twitter. Use the hashtag WAS on Twit. Now, let us get to work. I'm in the middle of security now a few minutes ago, and Eileen, my producer, comes running in and says, quick, there's a streaming Facebook press conference with Microsoft. And I thought, oh, my God, it's finally happened. I don't know what. Something. Microsoft, anytime Microsoft and Facebook
bought Microsoft, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Microsoft owns 5% of Facebook. They got a good deal. They put $240 million in. It's worth probably twice that now.
And everybody made fun of them, $15 billion. How ridiculous. And it is double that now.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah, the valuation that Microsoft's purchase gave them made it a $15 billion company, and everybody agrees it's 33 or more now. Nice move, Microsoft. And Facebook has done a deal in some odd way with Microsoft. According to the press conference, Mark Zuckerberg was there along with Chi Lu, who's the search guy at Bing. And they're going to add, and by the time you hear this, probably it will have already happened, a Facebook module to Bing that will essentially incorporate Facebook's personalization into Bing search. Now, if you go to Yelp right now and you have a, if you've ever logged into Facebook, you have the Facebook cookie on your machine, you go to Yelp, it'll say, hey, your name here. It'll even show you a picture of yourself and say, many of your friends are also here. Would you like to know more? And it's a little creepy when it first happens. I think it happens on Pandora as well, doesn't it?
Yep. Among other sites.
And when I first saw it, I thought, well, I don't know if I really want them to do that. You can turn it off. It's called a Facebook personalization. Besides Pandora and Yelp, who else does it, Robert?
Rotten Tomatoes, I know.
Rotten Tomatoes does it too?
Yeah.
Okay. It hasn't been a huge thing. I mean, not a lot of sites are doing it yet. And it's very, and it's more subtle than it used to be. You used to get a big colored bar. Now it's just a little bit of text right at the tippity top of the page that says, Yelp is using Facebook to personalize your experience. And then you see friends activity, 100, and you see some options. What is this? Being the first. Not you, log out of Facebook. And don't want to be connected, how to turn this off. But if you click friends activity, you'll see what people who are my Facebook friends have done recently on Yelp. Similarly, when you search for something on Bing, and they gave a few examples. If you search for a Toyota Prius on Bing, you'll see which of your Facebook friends have liked it, reviewed Priuses, have liked articles about Priuses. You'll get results, Prius results, based on your social graph. They showed searching for movies and TV shows. They showed, interestingly, searching for people and the ability to customize your experience according to something Chi Lu called social proximity. And I thought this was kind of in, kind of like location-based search, where it knows where you are, so it gives you results that are appropriate to your zip code. Social proximity-based search would say know who your social graph is and give you name search results that are appropriate to who you know. So if I search for Jeff, I'm going to get Jeff Jarvis, assuming that you're my Facebook friend. I don't even know if you are.
I certainly hope so.
It will be available, as I said, by the time you hear this, they said this afternoon, which we're recording Wednesday, October 13th, so Wednesday afternoon. Still to come, they'd like to bring in likes and profile pics anywhere across search results, not just in a Facebook module. By the way, that module rides pretty high on the page. It's well above the fold. It looks like it's like almost the second item in there. They'd also like to be able to kind of give you some information about which of your friends are experts. So the example Facebook gave is if you search for the Meritage restaurant in Sonoma County, just up the road a bit from here, it would show which of your friends have actually been there. So when you read the reviews, you know these people might know whereof they speak. Robert, for a long time, you've talked about using the social graph in search and how much juice Facebook has because of all this social information. Is this the other shoe dropping?
Part of it, and it, certainly it exposes the rift with Google. Google, if you work at Google, by the way, you're not allowed to integrate Facebook in any real way into any Google product. And there's a widening rift. When I talk to executives at Google, they think Facebook is enemy number one to aim at right now.
Yeah, isn't that what Eric Schmidt said? He said, I don't fear Apple. I don't fear Facebook. I fear Bing. And actually, in fact, now he can fear Facebook and Bing together.
Yep. And that's probably why he feared getting Bing, because Bing could get back in the game and get some more percentage of share away. Each percentage, I think Danny Sullivan said, is $1 billion or something like that. So
right.
In revenue a year, something right. Like that. Something crazy, a big number.
Calacanis has always said that too. Yeah, each percentage of search business is a $1 billion.
Wow.
So now if you can get, you know, even a few percent of the Facebook users to use Bing instead of Google, that's pretty significant.
Laura, your colleague Ben Parr was there. He covered it live. Mashable did a live blog of it. I don't know if you got a chance to watch what was going on. What are your thoughts on this?
So I didn't get to see the announcement, but I did read Ben's post, and I've kind of been following it. I think it's extremely interesting, and it's certainly something I'll want to check out once it does go live. But at the same time, a lot of what Google has done to incorporate, Twitter into search results hasn't necessarily made that search experience better for me personally. I know they like to talk that it's enhancing that. So, I mean, really, it's going to be in terms of utility. Like, knowing that my friend liked a movie is maybe a little bit more interesting than knowing that they, liked a Toyota Prius. I mean, I don't really care that they like a Toyota Prius. I care if maybe they own one or if maybe they know someone who owns one and that experience. So I think there's a little bit more to it than just the like, and I want to see it and play with it before, I can actually say, oh, hey, this is amazing. But I do think it's part of the,
Although Jennifer, when social is put on a search listing, like Plantcast, I love Plantcast because it shows how many people are going to the web versus, Gnome Decks. And I can decide which event to go to based on who my, which of my friends are going there and how many are going there.
Right. That has direct relevance. That's what Jennifer's saying, I think, sure. is that just to find out that somebody going to the web also happens to drive a Renault means nothing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So the relevance is very high. And so there's a subtlety to this to give me people who are doing things that, that add value to the search and don't just say, oh, we're social, which is the risk for both Bing and Google.
No. Right.
Well, Google's been doing, in fact, there's a social link right now. If you go to Google and you click the social link on the sidebar there, it'll give you nearby. It'll give you social. And so I search for Le Web and social, and so I can get, I guess these are people who I'm connected to via Twitter, via friend feed, I see, via Wave. I guess they haven't disconnected that yet. So Google's obviously sees the value of this and has done some of this. But Google, as you said, Robert, Google doesn't have Facebook. How important is Facebook to this?
Well, most normal people use Facebook. The geeks in the audience are probably on Twitter, but right. And people who love watching celebrities are probably on Twitter. But normal people, my wife is a Facebook fanatic. So if you want to reach people like that, you got to be on Facebook. You got to integrate Facebook in.
Right, right. So this is potentially a differentiator between Bing and Google and something that could be of value. You can see why Microsoft would do this.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you can see why, Google's been trying to go for some social thing we're yet to see. And by the way, I'm told that whatever that is imminent.
Well, yeah. And, there's some, I would give it some credence because of another big story, which is that Marissa Meyer has moved from what is really the catbird seat, being in charge of search at Google, to being in charge of location.
Yeah. I think that's the new catbird seat, Leo.
You think?
Eric Schmidt has said recently that he said a while ago that Google will eventually make more money from mobile than from the web. And it makes as much as God on the web. And figuring out that strategy, figuring out how to give you relevance and intent in a logical way through not just tablets and phones, but being connected through your cars and every which way. I keep on saying we're going to make mobile becomes, that's why I'm glad they didn't call it mobile. Mobile is an irrelevant word.
Yeah.
This is about.
So this is the same as mobile, though. In that, I mean, it's as valuable as mobile.
Yes, it's around you. Sorry,
I think this is the third wave of the web. The first wave was search, right, and that's what Google capitalized on. Second wave was social. That's what Facebook and a whole bunch of other things, LinkedIn and Google Buzz and whatever capitalized on. Now it's location and mobility added to search and social, and this is the third wave. It's very important. I think she's still, I totally agree with Jeff that she's still in the catbird seat. Plus you'll probably get one of those cool Google cars that drives her around, right?
We're gonna talk about that in a second, because Robert, you had the scoop on it, but you buried the lead 9 months ago.
I had no idea. I was driving right next to the coolest car in the world.
You buried the lead. But let's talk some more about Marissa Meyer. The New York Times, which broke this story, says in the sentence number one of the third paragraph, the change is a promotion for Ms. Meyer. In case there were any question about her being demoted, she was also named to Google's operating committee of top decision makers. So this is,
Is she a senior VP now? She was a VP, not a senior VP, I think. Does this have a rank and hashtags?
I don't see a rank, at least in the New York Times thing. That's an interesting question. Yeah, she was VP of Search Projects and User Experience, and very famously was the one, the keeper of the clean interface at Google.com.
when you talk to her backstage at conferences, it's very clear that she has her fingers in every major acquisition that Google's doing, and probably a lot of the strategic direction as well.
She was their 20th employee, the first female engineer there, and has really been trusted with the keys to the kingdom. I think it's very telling that you take this person, this very, very important person, and you say, you are now in charge of, let me give you this exact title, Geographic and Local Services. Now, the New York Times article says that this is an indication that Google is taking the business, the local business market, very seriously. But it's got to be more than just local business.
Certainly more than that. You know, Google's always taken that seriously, and they've been really trying to push place pages for a long time now, and there's been a number of feature upgrades on that front. But I think what they've shown, you know, over the course of the past few years is that they don't really understand how consumers want to use location. So, you know, latitude of technology is great, it's there, but it's not exactly consumer friendly. It's a little bit too implicit. And then they messed up with Dodgeball. So they had they had Crowley, and they had his innovation, and they had that kind of, you know, a little bit of magic around that location. And then they kind of dropped that. And so they get the business side. I wouldn't say that they're doing it, you know, perfectly right now, and they can certainly improve upon that. But in terms of like the consumer, I don't think that they've ever released a product that is kind of a must use or even has the weight of a Foursquare.
Yeah.
John Battelle in his search blog says location is a key factor in the future of search, social, commerce, and media, among a lot of other things. Obviously, he thinks it's very important.
It's the most important signal. Google's all about intuiting intent, and Marissa understands that in her DNA. And so the signals that Google can take to do things with you, right? Social is one, but location is in a way the most reliable. I'm going to give you what's around you now.
John uses the phrase database of intentions.
Yeah.
That location is an important critical element in understanding intent.
Now, it's true. When you talk to Google VPs, they talk about when you walk into a store, for instance, you are communicating to the world that you have intent to do something. I used to run retail store, and my boss used to say, nobody walks in the front door without an intent to buy from you.
Right.
So make sure that they buy something from you before they leave.
I love that. He then knew that. I think it was Larry Page, Sergey Brin, who said, we want to, what would be the third part of your brain. We want to know what you want before you want it. And everybody thought that was kind of creepy.
Yeah. Well, and Eric Schmidt said a few weeks ago that we know where you are and what you want.
Right. And that's what this is. That's
a lot of creepiness, yeah.
This kind of discovering what the intent is.
Soon you're driving, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, and Robert, I haven't thanked you, but Robert and I had, before it died, a Wave interview for my next book. And I just used part of what Robert was saying about when you were at a photo store, you memorized the inventory and prices of your competitor as well as your own store. You were a database.
Yep.
Right? You were presenting this kind of valuable information to somebody, and that's what Google is. You know, right. that's what it is entirely.
I did that because I was paid on commission, and if you could sell something faster than the guy next to you, you would make more. And looking prices up in a book wasted time. So
wow.
I memorized them all.
That's dedication, Robert. I'm surprised you're not still working in a camera store.
I'd love to, but in a way, I still am.
You are. It's just more than cameras, that's all.
I'm having a mental block right now, or a senior moment. Who's the Google executive everybody likes who was on Android and then was moving over to kind of local? And I wonder what, I thought that he just had a role in local, and I wonder how this matters against him.
Who, Vic?
Vic Guindotra?
Vic, thank you, Vic.
Oh, yeah.
What's Vic's new job?
He's building the next social piece
he's
that's going to compete with Facebook. And I just talked to him a couple of days ago, and he knows his job is hard.
Right. Well, it's interesting. Now, do you move Marissa because you're about to go social, like you're about to launch this platform, or is this Marissa planning for the next platform?
Both, because Google's strength is they know, they have a graph of all the places in the world. This is why they can drive that car down the road, right? They have maps of the road. They understand the businesses. When you search, in fact, if you want to find out how to get to the Twit Cottage, the Twit Cottage is on Google Maps. Well, why? Because Google has a social graph of the businesses in the world, and they understand that.
Well, Facebook, because I tell you why, because I added it to Places. That's why. But they've incented, as Jennifer said, they've always taken this very seriously, and they've incented people to do that, and there's a lot of reasons to add yourself to Places, and they do this. It's complicated. You get a postcard in the mail saying, were you really the guy? Or you can verify in other ways. I think they can call your phone number. But
I mean, I've always thought that in terms of technology, Google, you know, they've built the infrastructure to be great at location. But it's not a technology problem, at least in terms of consumer. Like I said before, it's an emotion thing. They can't create an emotion that wants, you know, that kind of, you know, ties you to any of their products that they have.
So then that raises the question, is this Facebook Bing thing late to the party? Oh, they suddenly discovered social and Google said, social's nice, but we're doing location. Have they leapfrogged? Is this something better than?
Oh, absolutely. No, of course not. Because first, they're different. But at the same time, Facebook has their Facebook Places. And I'll bet that this gets incorporated into this pretty soon as well. Because, you know, your friends like in a restaurant. I think that was even an example that showed up.
They did. I mean, that's right. They said the Meritage, we can tell if he's an expert, whether he's been there or not.
So
I don't know. I tried to switch my iPhone over to Bing for a month, and I just don't like the search results as good as well. So for me, this is not enough to switch me over to Bing. I'll play with it a little bit to see what's fun about it, but it hasn't nailed the search experience.
Yeah, I think Leo, the question you're asking, two different questions. One is a user question, which of course is always where Google starts, but the bottom line is not a user question at all, it's an ad question. Where is the higher value going to be in commerce and advertising, and where is all the growth going to be? Well, you know, I talked to hyperlocal businesses, and basically there are those who are saying already that not only have newspapers, but local blogs have already lost out to Google on place pages and such. Now, I don't agree with that, but that is where the war is going to be. And if Google is going to drive your car to the nearest pizza and, you know, hello, we just delivered you a prospect, you know, it's kind of beautiful. And so I think that on the advertising front, there's huge growth to be had, and there's a huge signal to be had. I think Jennifer's absolutely right. It's not as if it's one or the other, and Google would kill to have Facebook, I'm sure, but they make the best of what they have, and this is going to be really important.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the creepy factor, because as soon as Facebook and Bing announced this, I think privacy issues crop up. And a lot of the questions that Mark Zuckerberg and the others took at the event today were basically privacy questions. We're going to talk about that in just a second. I want to take a little break. We are talking about Google in the cloud on This Week in Google. And joining us, we're very glad to have Jennifer Van Grove from Mac. She's sucking away at her. That's all right,
Coffee.
Jennifer. You may have your beverage. You thought this was a time for breaking, and it is.
You look like you're on weeds.
She does. She has the clutch, the claw. What's her name that in weeds? Mary Louise Parker. She's always holding the. I don't know why. Is that and sucking her frappuccino through a claw? I don't know. Anyway, that's something.
It's not intentional for me, anyways.
Did you do the claw?
I did.
Let me see how you grasp it. Yep, that's the Mary Louise Parker claw. All right, so maybe that's just normal.
Yeah.
It's a female thing. I don't know.
It's a girl thing. Because guys like to hold it like that. That's another story. Also here, Jeff Jarvis from BuzzMachine.com. The Scobalizer is also here. Robert Scobal. And we will be back with more. And we'll talk privacy and how men like to hold it. But first, let me tell you a little bit about Squarespace.com. A great place to make your next website. Whether it's a blog, a photo site, or any kind of website at all, Squarespace is the secret behind exceptional websites. I want you to take a look. If you go to squarespace.com/twig right now, you can take a look. There's a free 2-week trial. Don't even need a credit card. It's so easy to create a new web page on Squarespace. You give it the site name. Let's say Twig. You give it a password. I don't know. I am a tree, and then you give it the email address, and that's it. And then the capture, and you're done, and you've got the site. Now here's something very cool. Squarespace can import your existing blog very easily, or website, if you're using movable type, WordPress, Typepad, or Blogger, or And most sites support these APIs, so almost any site, you can just import all your content, including comments, right over, including images, right over, so you'll see what that sample blog or website looks like. Squarespace is both hosting and software. It really is the best hosting ever. We keep trying, as a fun little exercise. We're so good at bringing down websites here at Twit. We keep trying to bring down Squarespace websites. We've yet to do it. We've yet to do it. And the nice thing about having the software hosted for you is it's always up to date. It's always patched. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to worry about it. If you're using other blogging platforms, you know, how many times you have to go, uh-oh, security flaw, got to update. And if you don't, you're in trouble. Not with Squarespace. Squarespace is always up to date, always secure. Squarespace is gorgeous, too. And the best way to find that out is to look at the examples. Every Squarespace site looks different. They're all beautiful. Whether it's a business, a photography studio, an art studio, just give it a try. Squarespace.com/twig. And if you decide to sign up, Squarespace sites start at $12 a month. If you decide to sign up, you'll take 10% off for the life of the site each and every month if you use the coupon code TWIG. T-W-I-G. Squarespace.com/twig. The secret behind exceptional websites. Leo Laporte thanks. Here. Say?
Thanks to you, Leo. I've been recommending Squarespace to my students.
Oh, good. Yeah, perfect for a student. Perfect yeah. for a student. I can go on and on. I won't because we have other things to talk about. So I always get a little creeped out when I see the Facebook personalization. It's like, whoa. You know, and I think it's one of the reasons that, the like button has just taken off everywhere. Every site. If you don't have a like button, all of my podcasters on the Twit Network are saying, why don't we have like buttons? Everybody knows that's how you generate traffic is through a like button. But very few sites have adopted this Facebook personalization. Yelp, you can name them on the fingers of one hand. And I think that it's because there's a creepy factor, even though we know that it's just a cookie, that no information. In fact, Zuckerberg said, look, no, Bing is not getting any more information from us than you would get if you went and you looked at that person's profile. It's whatever they've made public. So anybody could do it anytime. We're just giving them the information, you know, programmatically. He also said no information goes from Bing to Facebook. That's a concern, right? That right. Facebook might be storing your search information. I mean, bad enough Google knows everything we search, but you know, Facebook could, and who knows, you know, how long that'll last? Because as we know, Facebook's willing to change things. Does this concern you? Is this addition into a search engine something of concern? Will it actually scare people away from Bing, Jeff?
With the privacy, it certainly will in Germany, where they go nutty about this. Even on Yelp and things, I think it does come to a question of value and relevance. When the like button came up from Facebook, I was one of those who said, oh, there's privacy problems there because it's going to report information back. And I was wrong and nobody cares and it's fine. So the same may be true here, but I think it's mainly creepy. I think if it comes out of left field, if it's really useful right off the bat, for Robert to know what other people are going to the same conference he's going to so he can stalk them. Yeah. You know, would sound even worse in a way, but it is more relevant.
Robert, you're like ceiling cat. You're looking to... ah! So it's all an implementation because the like button, you're right. I mean, I said at the time, oh, I'll never use the like button because I don't want to give Facebook a window into the world of my users. But, it comes a time when you just got to give up on these things.
I think right now it's a conditioning experiment. So web users were not used to going to a page and seeing the content personalized for us. And so it's a little bit unfamiliar, maybe feels like there's something creepy going on. And Facebook is pushing that, you know, pushing that boundary, pushing against it, and, you know, conditioning us to think a little bit differently about how a web page, how the content on the page can be shown to us in different ways. And I know that My Sixth Sense is kind of going down that path as well. They have their own formula and they're trying to get website publishers to implement their API so that when you go to a page, what you see is completely personalized to who you are. So I think that the whole web is going in that direction. It's not just Facebook. Facebook just happens to be the one who's doing it right now in the kind of the most obvious way.
I guess the difference for me is My Sixth Sense, I'm opting in to use My Sixth Sense. When I go to a website, when I go, I do a search and all of a sudden other, you know, your face and your face and your face shows up in the search results. That's kind of creepy.
Yeah, you know, Leo, except you added that data into Facebook and made it public, and you there's ways to remove it if you're that.
Yeah, but it's disconnected from the experience. So it happened at a different time.
It's the buzz problem.
It's the buzz problem.
Yeah. But I expected this to be used in this way, and oops, whoa, when it's used that way, that surprises me. You know, I think that Google would be more clever about this. I think the idea of just saying, oh, these are pages your friends have liked or something, doesn't help me. Whereas if you really study my social graph and find out that I hang out with geeks, that when I search for Windows, I'm not looking for Windex. Right? Yeah. That you can make the algorithm smarter in far more subtle and meaningful and relevant ways than just these obvious supposedly social things, which are really just they're window dressing.
And these semantic search systems that are just coming probably soon, the one I saw today is coming out in November. They do exactly that. They understand the context of who you are,
right?
Because of the graph of things that you touch and the people that you talk with. And so it knows exactly that you're talking about Microsoft Windows, not, you know, Windows Cleaner or something like that.
What is semantic search, Robert, just before we moved on? What is that?
Well, systems that are using these semantic databases track entities like Leo Laporte and track all sorts of data about Leo Laporte. So you can click on your name and see, you know, photos, videos, pictures, associated news articles about you, stuff like that. So click on a recipe and it knows, oh, these are food ingredients. It doesn't take you to paint, right? Or something else. It takes you to things that are associated with that entity, with that topic that you're trying to learn more about.
It understands what you're asking for. It understands what you're saying.
It's looking for signals to intuit intent again, rather than just saying, you have this connection.
Yeah.
So the more, I mean, you know, Amazon should be doing that. If I could put my Facebook, look at this way. If I could put my Facebook stuff into Amazon and it just knew who I knew and it behind the scenes, without revealing nothing to me, knows what all my friends buy, then it would recommend Leo Laporte books to me.
Right.
Yeah. The guy who did the Amazon system that does that guessing of what else you would be interested in. You know, you bought Harry Potter. Here's some other books that you might be interested in. Now owns Wurl, by the way, and they just announced, which is a competitor to Foursquare and Gowalla, and they just announced this kind of lookup. You know, you've gone to 800 places. Here's some other places that we think you would like based on the social graph that is around those places.
And the irony is that Microsoft bought a company that did that. My friend and partner on Daylife, Upendra Chardanand, out of his MIT Media Lab dissertation, did collaborative filtering and did the original Ringo, remember, which became, now I'm forgetting the name of it. Oh, this is horrible. Became
we're all getting old. Our brains are gone.
Oh, tell me about it. At least you got a laser in your head, so you got an excuse, Robert.
My pixels are dead.
He's got a hole in his head, it looks like.
I'll move over here.
but the reason Microsoft bought it was to get the wallet feature, which, of course, no one trusted Microsoft to use. And they had collaborative filtering in a way that they could have built into search long, long, long ago and didn't know what to do with it.
You can move too fast for people. I mean, you can scare them away. And I keep thinking that more and more now, maybe it's because I saw that movie, but more and more I'm thinking Mark Zuckerberg is kind of several steps ahead of the rest of us. Yeah. And so he's kind of the difference between Mark and maybe some others is he's pushing us farther and faster then we are really ready to go, even though we may at some point say, okay, yeah, that's a good place to be.
Yeah, and I think Larry and Sergey and Eric are and Marissa and company are ahead of us, too.
But they're cognizant of the risk, I think, in a way that Mark is not.
Also, I think the challenge is that they've got more of a challenge. I interviewed Eric last week for my book, and it was an interesting interview, but there was some line going by about what's your biggest challenge, and he said growth. And I think it means both sides of that, to keep on growing big, but also to keep doing things that are ahead of us when you're so damn big.
Well, the stock market requires massive growth, multiples, you know, big, like doubling every year for your stock price to go up. Just look at Microsoft stock price versus Apple's, which, by the way, is now at over $300 today.
Yeah.
Jeez Louise.
I sold it at 22 before it split.
Because you knew. You knew, didn't you? You knew where it was headed, didn't you? No, well, and Google's is flattened.
And I went to Microsoft. That shows you how smart I was. Right.
But you can see how there's a pressure for a public company, if they want to keep those stock valuations up, and that's how you acquire talent, to grow at all costs. But so that's clearly one thing Eric was talking about. But I think just managing existing growth is challenging.
Exactly. Right? That's the problem. So Zuckerberg is smart. He is ahead of things, and he still has a company that's right-sized to change. And as he said in the movie, we don't know what it is yet.
Yeah.
And I think that's a huge advantage for him still. And not being a public company remains a huge advantage for him. And it's hard to be Google. It's getting harder every day to be Google. It's wonderful to be Google. We should all be Google, but it gets harder.
I don't want to be Google.
You don't want to be Google?
Too much growth. It makes me scared.
I just want a Google car.
You got to, it's funny because Robert, you had the scoop 9 months ago. If you go to YouTube and you search for autonomous vehicles.
Yeah.
There's Robert driving alongside a car that, well, did you not know it was autonomous?
I did know. I knew it was an interesting car. I thought it was a mapping car because
it had
the spinning LiDAR on the top of it.
Yeah.
And I thought that they were driving around making 3D maps of the world. But I kept seeing them. I've seen them maybe a dozen to 20 times on the freeways here. They've been driving them
a lot. They're stalking you.
Well, they drive them around. They drive them around Mountain View. They drive them around here, right?
Yeah.
And they've logged 140,000 miles.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So they got to be driving them around somewhere.
Yeah. No, I've seen them in Half Moon Bay. I've seen them, you know, driving around, and I got video of them twice. In fact, last December I had video of another one. So I keep seeing these cars, and I just find them fascinating creatures to look at because of the spinning LiDAR. So last night it was really fascinating. The wife of the inventor of LiDAR calls me up and tells me a little bit about what went into developing that LiDAR. It turns out the guy who Dave Hall, I think is his name, invented LiDAR, was the inventor of the Velodyne subwoofer, which I sold in my camera store in the 1980s.
And so, how much did that cost at Ritz Camera?
No, the LiDAR?
No,
you can buy a LiDAR for $29,000 now. So,
how does that differ from radar?
It's a spinning laser. So it has, I think, a row of lasers.
Here's your video from 9 months ago, and you could see the LiDAR. You actually have clearer video than anybody does.
And it spins these lasers and spits lasers out to the street, to the trees, to the cars around you, to humans around you, and measures that laser coming back, and then makes a 3D image in real time of the world around it. If you go to Engineering TV, you'll actually see some video of the LiDAR. I posted on Twitter last night, and the imagery that comes back from it. And you can see lane markings, you can see trees, you can see people walking around, you can see everything in the environment around the car, and this LiDAR spinning around 5 times a second. So every fifth of a second, it makes a new picture of that environment. And if a car moves a little bit closer to it, that LiDAR sees it. Now, the guys at Stanford and Carnegie Mellon used that imagery to write algorithms for controlling a robot, a car in this case, around this environment. And so they wrote algorithms to say, oh, that's a tree. You don't have to worry about that unless you're heading straight forward. You know, that's a car and it's moving the same speed you are. That's a different kind of object than, you know, a car heading straight towards you. And, you know, that's what the Google guys are doing, is writing these algorithms to understand the environment and understand how to stop at a stoplight. How do you know that that's a stoplight you're looking at? Okay, we can see that on the LiDAR. We see the position of the light, which was really brilliant engineering when somebody developed a stoplight to make it a different position than the green light so that the LiDAR can measure that. And off you go.
Oh, that's clever. Do you think they did it on purpose? No.
I don't know, someday
there'll be LiDAR.
No, it's a cold one. But I think they did that because humans can't discern color very well, but we can discern position. And LiDAR isn't really good at discerning color, but position. And you have on your screen an example of a LiDAR.
This is from Engineering TV, by the way.
Yeah, it's probably walking around in an environment. They put one in the exhibit hall, and you can see people walking around. Right. Now they're putting one on a military vehicle.
Two things. One, you shot that video while you were driving. Remind me never to get a ride with you.
No kidding. But it was very clear. It was very nice video.
Here's the trick, though, because my car has some of this technology built into it. So I have a camera in my car that keeps me in the lane. And my car has a radar on the front of it that automatically follows cars in front of it. So I can actually do a little bit more than just drive with my car. And my car is maybe 10% of going toward the Google system. My car, if somebody slams on their brakes in front of me, my car slams on its brakes. It's really a remarkable system. And I think every car should have it. I think in 10 years, if your car doesn't have this, you're going to wonder why it doesn't have it. The same way today, if you didn't have a car with seatbelts, you would be like, I'm not getting
it. Do you feel out of control?
Oh, this is remarkable technology. It puts you back in control, and it's way faster and way more safe than you are. It doesn't fall asleep. It reacts faster to road conditions. It can see stuff that you don't see that maybe is a blind spot that you have. It works at night in conditions where your human eye can't see. I came up on a car that didn't have any back lights and totally pitch at dark at night, and I couldn't see this car, but my radar slowed down because it saw the car. And so these things are going to save lives. It's just humans are very resistant to these new technologies and letting technology take over their lives this way.
Well, one of the reasons you didn't know what you were taking a picture of is there's a guy at the wheel.
Yeah.
And it looks like somebody's driving.
That was my question. If you do a frame analysis, are his hands on the wheel?
I couldn't quite see that. It looked like it, but I couldn't see that.
I bet you, I mean, look, they don't want to scare the hell out of people.
They don't want to scare people. No.
I think it would be funny if they put a monkey in the driver's seat.
Well, what was funny, and I should have, you know, if I had a news team working for me, I should have thought about this. The guy instantly put on his brakes when I came alongside.
Oh, he did. He slowed down. Yeah.
He saw my camera, and he stepped hard on those brakes.
Yeah, yeah.
So in the car, they all have manual override systems, and they can, you know, click a button or step on a brake and get out of a situation.
It's pretty obvious. This is a Larry or Sergey or both kind of vanity project, something they want to do and they think is neat.
Yeah, that was the argument online where Henry Blodgett said that they shouldn't be doing it in the company for the stockholders' sake, and also the better way to develop this is a startup.
See, I disagree.
I agree with Arrington, who said this is the thing for them to do.
Well, they got to do something.
Well, first of all, understanding, doing research like this will find you some new things. For instance, it might turn into better turn-by-turn navigation on our cell phones, right? Even if you're not going to use a car that drives itself, you might get a benefit because they understand the environment better. They understand all sorts of different signals and signs, and they can warn you about turns that are dangerous. If you're going too fast into a turn, your phone might warn you. Trapster does this for me, right? People have marked certain turns as being very dangerous or have put in there that there's a police camera a stoplight camera at a certain intersection, so don't run the red light here, you know, and it warns you as you're driving around. It talks to you. It says, hey, don't run the next red light.
Yeah,
you know? Well, you think of the economic implications, you know, if we use this, could be huge. It's gonna save lives. It's gonna save money from that. It's gonna save fuel. It's going to allow emergency vehicles to go around. It's going to provide more spare time, which is what Eric said before this.
And I'm sure it's cheaper than owning three company jets anyway.
Yeah.
Well, they spend money on a lot of things.
I'm going to be the huge naysayer and say that, you know, I'm not really interested. I mean, the technology is impressive, but I'm one of those, you know, those drivers that when I'm driving, I like to be in control of my car. Like I've had cars with cruise control. I don't use it. Obviously, Robert, I totally agree that the technology is important technology and will certainly go a long way. But there's also the that once this comes to market, or even in the testing and you know, on the streets, that if something catastrophic happens, then it's going to be Google's name in the lights in a very negative way, and that will potentially negative, you know, affect the stock. So it is, it's an interesting.
I think that's why they were trying to keep it secret. You know, the New York Times found out about it and forced Google to talk about this. Google didn't want to talk about it in public. I interviewed the guy, the head of safety at Ford, and he said exactly this, that he's done customer research, and most customers don't like the idea of having a car in control. So in the Ford Taurus, the 2010 Ford Taurus, or now the 2011, they have these radar systems, but they don't take control of the car. They just warn you when you're about to hit something, or you're doing something stupid, or you're falling asleep.
That's the Bliss system they have there.
Yeah, and that's smart, right? That also demonstrates where this research could expose itself, even for somebody like Jennifer. She might want these kinds of safety technologies. She doesn't want the car to drive, but she, you know, if you're about to hit something, you fell asleep at the wheel, you'd want to be warned about that and get woken up.
Jennifer, I think you're right about current culture. I think, Robert, you're right about where it's going to expose. Jennifer, I think you're right about current culture, but you start to imagine a time when you really could take time off, do something as you drive, which is what Eric talked about. You imagine maybe being financially rewarded, that if you let the car drive you, you don't owe any insurance. And that there are other ways to consider how, you know, the there could be economic motives here that really matter. What hit me was, I always thought that it was an all or nothing, that either the roads are entirely controlled by technology or not. The idea that you can have an automatically driven car interacting with human driven cars that's what was revelatory to me.
Yeah. I interviewed the guy who wrote the software for the Stanford car, and he now works on the Google team. I interviewed him back in 2007, and I asked him, well, how do you decide who gets to go through an intersection? You know, if you have a four-way stop, and let's say you have two robot cars come and two human cars, humans know how to look at each other and decide which way to who goes first, right? But how does a robot decide that? And he said, well, we've come up with algorithms that will move the car a couple inches into the intersection, and if nobody else moves, it goes a couple more inches.
That's what I do.
Yeah,
and
if anybody else moves, then they stop and wait until you know, and decide a random set time before they try again. And
when they tie Facebook in, it shows that you hang around with a fast crowd.
I think it's a very interesting thing to do. I'm with you, Robert. You know, when I talked to Alan Mulally at Ford, he said people like to drive their own cars. We don't have any plans to do autonomous vehicles. I think what we're seeing, though, is that autonomous vehicles are here. Yeah. And consumers may not want them, but they're here. And it may be in time that there might be other overriding considerations like highway safety, fuel.
We don't always like to drive our cars, though. I don't like to drive across Nevada, you know, which is a very straight road and very boring.
Right.
I think this will be used in the trucking industry, by the way, because those people are getting paid to drive. And if you could buy one of these devices, right now that LiDAR costs $29,000 and the PC that goes in the car cost $5,000.
All it takes is one horrendous crash.
I don't think you're going to see a crash with these things. They are so fast and so accurate at reading the environment around them that they're going to avoid crashes more often than they're going to get in them.
But it's ironic. I mean, we have horrendous crashes every single day.
Yeah, 40,000 people in the United States die a year.
But nobody's saying, well, humans ought not to be allowed to drive cars. One crash. In fact, I think of the Bucky Fuller's Dymaxion car. He invented a very efficient, brilliant three-wheel vehicle. And unfortunately, it got in a fatal accident, and the test driver died, and that was it.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
That was it. It was over.
Cars have only been in one accident, by the way, and it was rear-ended by somebody else.
Right.
So,
but that's just it, though. I mean, you can't always account. Well, at least from my knowledge, you can't always account for the stupidity of other people. I mean, I'm sure the algorithms are very sophisticated, but how can it possibly know every single potential outcome of every single maneuver of every single car on the road?
It's pretty damn, when you see the LiDAR work, it's pretty damn good at figuring out that out, you know, and you can write algorithms. Hey, there's a car moving toward me. And my radar is so good that it doesn't see anybody coming toward me. I use it on a very curvy road, and people come right towards my front, and it's very good at discerning, oh, that car is coming toward me in the other lane, and I should ignore that. If you look at the video I did with Ford, they actually show on the screen what the algorithms are doing, and it's classifying each object that it sees, and it sees everything. It sees the line markers. It sees everything. It sees signs, right, coming toward you. Why wouldn't a car robot care about the sign? But it classifies that and says, oh, that's not dangerous to our environment. This car that's braking right now is dangerous to our environment, and we're going to do something about it. And it the artificial
What's
intelligence
the data,
real-time.
Robert, the data that's going through, that's happening locally in the car. The Google car, I assume, is going back to the cloud.
The Google car uses the maps data from the cloud to figure out where it's going next, right? And figure out a little bit about the space that it's in before it gets there. So it knows, like...
But the LiDAR calculations are happening locally, you're saying?
Locally, yeah. Because that's too much data to be sending. And it also, we all know how
AT&T
wireless is not very reliable, even if you have, Verizon.
So I think we know Jennifer would never drive an autonomous car.
Not never, but I...
You don't even like cruise control.
Jennifer, I'm trying to get a ride in one. You should come along. I want to see you sit in the back seat while this car drives.
Robert would buy one in a heartbeat and would sit back and read a book, text, Twitter, whatever.
Chris DeBono fell asleep in the one.
Did he really?
He was not the driver's seat, in the back seat.
So you are the guy, the tiebreaker, Jeff Jarvis. Would you ever ride?
You bet.
You'd do it. I would do it too. So actually, we outnumber you.
But isn't, like, you know, part of the thing about driving the experience, like, there are drivers out there who love to drive.
That's what Mullally said. He said people really like driving. We're not going to take it.
Guess what? You can turn it off. You can still drive it.
I loved my stick shift until it almost got me divorced before I was married because my wife won't drive one.
You know, I think it's really interesting. This is what I think is interesting, this is a very science fiction concept, and it's here. It actually happens. It works. It's there. It's done.
Yeah.
And, Google's had this for, we drove 140,000 miles. No big deal. It's like, what else is out there that we don't know about that's done, cooked?
And by the way, Vic at Google says they have some other secret projects that I don't know yet about. So
you gotta wonder.
Now I'm going to be watching what's on the road a lot more.
If you have,
or
you
in
know,
the skies.
One of the attitudes. Yeah. One of the attitudes I've heard Google say this. One of the attitudes at Google is they're engineers. Oh, there's a problem. We can engineer a solution.
Yeah.
Right.
And if you watch engineering TV, they just had some video of the General Electric video cameras or sensors that they're putting on planes and drones. I mean, this stuff looks like science fiction, but, it's amazing stuff. And it categorizes what's on the ground. Is that a threat? Is that,
As usual, it's the military that gets the first application, and they've been using LiDAR for years.
Well, the Stanford stuff was developed for the military, right? DARPA, sponsored the first autonomous car contest, and this stuff was designed for them. At Stanford, they were testing these quadcopter rotors, helicopters that now you can buy for $300, but those were developed for the military.
So who does engineering TV? This is great.
I don't know, but
we're going to give
a
big plug.
I just found it last night, and I'm in love. As a geek, you get the book around there, and it's very geeky. It's a little dense on engineering terms, but when you find once in a while, you'll find a video that's like, wow, that's possible. It's crazy.
It is. It looks like it's Electronic Design Magazine that does this. It's engineeringtv.com, and we thank them for unwittingly giving us permission to run that video of the LiDAR.
The internet. We all steal from each other.
We don't steal. We promote, Robert. We promote.
And that's why.
We send traffic to each other, right?
That's what I'm doing. I'm sending them traffic from one network broadcaster to another.
And hopefully they're using Squarespace so that they stay up.
There you go. Now you're cooking. Hey, we're going to talk about Google TV. There's more to say there as well in just a little bit. It's great to have you. Jennifer Van Grove from Mashable. Jeff Jarvis from Buzz Machine. I'm mixing you with Gina now. BuzzMachine.com and Robert Scoble from Scobalizer.com and Rackspace. Let's not. Let's give him a plug. Rackspace.
Hey.
Maybe Rackspace will get you a new camera. Somebody
will.
You've lasered your
camera.
These
are only like $690, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, the C510 that I was talking about, the new Logitech, is $60. It's really nice for $60.
Yeah.
Hey, briefly, I want to mention my friend Tom Johnson, who does the best anti-spam solution ever. MailRoute.info. I want you to check it out. Now, this is really for people who have their own servers. You know, if you're using Gmail, you've got anti-spam. Gmail does a great job, kills spam. I'm not going to try to sell you an anti-spam solution. But there are a lot of people who run their own mail server, exchange servers, or other kinds of servers for whatever reason. Or people who have their own domains like I do, leoville.com. For the last 6 years, I've been using MailRoute to kill spam before it even gets to my server. Now, I'm going to get a little geeky here. You set the MX record in your DNS records to MailRoute. It gets all your mail, filters out the junk, and then sends it on to you, and you get this kind of pristine stream. It's kind of like sewage treatment for your email. And let me give you an idea of how much sewage is in my email. Over the last 12 months, I got roughly 1 million messages, of which all but about 40,000 were spam. That means 96% spam. MailRoute got them all with not one false positive, and that's what I really like about MailRoute. Once you get it working, once you set it, you could forget it. It's just there. It just works. They are – now, Tom has gotten so much interest from people who say, but I would like an anti-spam solution, that he is now talking to individual users. So there are individual accounts there. You could check out the pricing at MailRoute.net. It starts, I think, as low as $2 per seat. I think there's a $20 minimum, although for individuals, they're going to do a special deal because – they realize if you just have one address, it's not quite, you know, worth $20 a month. So go to mailroute.info, take a look at the pricing, take a look at the setup. It's very good. Tom has been around for a long time. He created something called FrontBridge, which was acquired by Microsoft in 2005 and is now called Microsoft Exchange Hosted Services. He knows a little bit about mail. MailRoute is the best. 99.99% availability for message processing. It's up more than your server is. And you can try it free right now. MailRoute.info. If you use that URL, you get 10% off for life, for the life of your account. And you'll help support This Week in Google as well. Thank you, Tom, for your support. And thank you for checking out MailRoute. We are talking about, now, Google TV. Let's talk a little bit about that. I can't remember, Jeff. Did we talk about Google TV?
We did some last week, yeah.
Because the Logitech review had been announced that day.
The Logitech, yeah. So Sony now adds theirs. We saw the previews of the remote. The remote is true.
Ugly-ass remote.
It is, and it's. We said last week, it's so Sony. You know, oh, we need a button for this and a button for that, and it has no elegance, which is odd for Sony, given the days. But versus the Logitech, you know, do I want this little thing or a whole big keyboard?
Well, that's true.
The size of it does have some merit. So what I want to know is, I have a new Sony TV. I'm a jinx like you.
Yeah. And I wonder, like, just bought one,
add,
huh?
A Sony Google TV to it.
Well, see, that's the interesting thing, and I guess that's question number one, is what's the better way to do this? To buy a TV with the internet built into it, or my preference, maybe that's because I'm a geek, I like the idea of having a great TV. I don't care if it's got internet, and I will buy a box or two, or in my case, four. I only have five HDMI ports, and all of them are attached to Roku, Apple TV.
Yeah, but down the line, Leo, down the line, isn't your TV just going to be connected to your cloud?
I'll tell you why I don't like that. Because, Samsung, for instance, is doing their own thing. So that means their own UI, their own special flavor of stuff. And what I want is the ability to easily upgrade and the ability to choose, because there's very big differences between Google TV, Roku, Apple TV,
WDTV. That's what I'm saying. Is at some point, but we're not. It's the.
I want to choose the TV, Jeff, and get a great
the
TV.
The same way I want to choose a computer, and behind that is just the internet. I want to choose a TV, and behind that is just the internet.
Well, I tell you why I don't think that's good, because you really don't want to. Do you really want to put the internet on your TV and just have like a browser?
I want that same kind of openness that I don't have to buy different boxes to get different stuff. That's the balkanization here. That's absurd.
Yeah.
Right. If I want to connect to the world of entertainment, I shouldn't have to worry that Hulu's on this and not on that, and Showtime's on that.
But it is. But I mean, that's the case.
But that's not the way the world should work.
Well, but that's the way the world does work, Jeff.
For now.
So you think at some point there'll be a standards-based solution that
there has to be.
Okay,
there has to be, because you're going to get this thing we now call it's like at some point in the future the word mobile becomes meaningless, the word telephone becomes meaningless, and I'll get crap for this in the chat room, but what the hell. Even the word TV becomes meaningless because you may be watching this show on what you can now call a TV or on what we now call tablets or what we now call phones.
I think we're going to standardize around screen size. We have handheld iPad or slate, something like that screen, you know,
a desktop or a laptop.
And then a big screen, a 50, 60-inch screen.
Thank you, Robert. That's fine. But the point is, if I want to watch a Weeds on the brain now, because you did it to me, Jennifer, because of the claw. If I want to watch Weeds, I watch it on my iPod. I watch it on a tablet. I watch it on the TV. It doesn't matter what size device.
Well, Sony's going to be the first to market because they'll be in stores on Saturday. I think the way to talk about this is platform, right? I mean, what you want, and this is where Microsoft powered the PC revolution by building a standardized platform, not open, but standardized, called Windows, that so every developer could develop it for it, and many manufacturers could manufacture for it. And that the success of that platform was, I think, comes from those two facts, not from any particular technical merit, but merely ubiquity. The internet is a platform anybody can develop for. Now you have these proprietary platforms. You develop for the iPhone, you don't develop for Android. And, you know, anybody can develop for the iPhone. Anybody can develop for Android. You may develop for the iPhone and not get approved, but they're separate but equal. Let's say separate but equal platforms. And I think that's the future, isn't it? Isn't that? I mean, are we ever going to see us?
It's
a horrible future, but isn't that where we are?
What's where we are today? But by God, Leo, let's fight it.
In phones. I mean, I guess Android's your best bet for that. It's open source.
And right, but at some point, you know, Amazon just came out with its new short form books that they want to sell just on Kindle. So I can write the 40,000 word booklet, and it appears there, and you can't get it on, iBooks.
Well, I agree that holds it back.
Right, that's ridiculous. And so we wouldn't tolerate that. We don't tolerate that today with books. We think that's ridiculous that you can't get books on certain platforms. TV shows.
We may think it's ridiculous, but we do tolerate it.
I don't know. We tolerate it. We're stuck with it. And it's why I won't buy
a Kindle.
Kindle's where all the books are.
Do you have a Kindle?
I I'll use the Kindle app across any platform.
Well, so you've supported the balkanization in books.
All right.
You just did it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I agree with you. It's not desirable. In fact, the reason the PC succeeded is because it was that way. It could be very well the reason that Google TV or Android doesn't succeed because it isn't that way. Although you could say there are some negatives to the Android model. People have complained before about the fact that there are, 18 different ways of doing Android, and there's no Android. Two Android phones are alike, and all the horrible customizations that the companies, wireless carriers, do because they can.
And then everyone's running a different version of the operating system on their phone. So,
yeah, and I think we're headed towards that kind of balkanization in the TV space, where Samsung's got its platform, Panasonic's got it. There's Yahoo, there's Popcorn, there's Sony, there's Roku. It's ugly.
But are we really in that world where we tolerate them? Where we wouldn't tolerate Betamax versus VHS? We wouldn't tolerate Blu-ray versus whatever the hell the other one was.
True. No, but now we're tolerating Netflix versus Amazon or Netflix versus something else.
But this is my argument against having it in the TV, because then you buy into the space. You're kind of saying, okay, I've chosen Blu-ray. I've chosen HD TV.
Yeah, right. Okay, I buy that. But I think, Leo, down the line, you would certainly agree that if you could get a TV that just connected to the entertainment cloud, you'd be happiest.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So who's going to move? What are the forces that are going to move us that way?
Okay, so you get your TV and it's going to have Hulu and Netflix and YouTube and a few other things. And then, next year maybe ESPN comes out with this exclusive sports package that's only available on boxy.tv.
Right.
So you're going to go and buy a boxy. It's going to cost you $100.
But let's talk about the business model behind that, right? ESPN's interest in the early stages of technology is to get somebody to pay them. And that's why content went exclusively with one phone company versus another at the beginning, because the phone company would pay to differentiate. ESPN's business model in the long run is to get largest audience possible, either for advertising or subscription or both. So it doesn't pay for ESPN in the long run to be stuck with just the AOL in the future, yeah. Right? That's what AOL and Prodigy and Microsoft did back in the day. Now, of course, it was absurd because you could go around, but once the web came along, it just killed all that.
Yeah. I'm already noticing some brands that are common. I mean, I have an Xbox, I have a PlayStation, I have a Roku, I have a Apple TV, I have a Mac Mini with a boxy on it, and I'm going to get the Google TV if I can find $300 in my gadget budget.
You've got a great wife, Robert. You've got a great wife.
I do.
I bet you Miriam can't figure out how to watch TV, though.
No, she's doing all right. The Apple TV is actually
pretty
easy.
You're going to have to buy a separate TV for your family. So that they can watch
TV's
it.
TV's not that hard because the Comcast box does right. The TV, right?
Exactly. Or
in our case, we have a DirecTV.
Exactly.
And that we figured out because you have to figure that out if you want to watch, CNN and stuff like that. You have to figure out how to use that. It's all the other stuff like Netflix now. You know, which system are we going to buy? Are we going to watch Netflix on? So far, the Apple TV's won. So,
Jennifer, what do you watch on?
I'm an Apple TV person, but I will probably get some sort of TV that has Google TV just because I want to see if it is what, you know, it promises to be, because I do think that there's long-term potential there. But in terms of like consumer preference, you know, so far consumers have voted for the, you know, the extra box, right? So the DVD yeah. player. And I'm not sure if they're going to be, you know, ready for this. Okay, well, the internet is integrated into my TV experience. I'm not sure that they're going to be ready for that. And it should be interesting to see how people respond to it. And I'll certainly be watching that. But I want to play with it myself. And search is a huge problem, though, that is, you know, cable providers kind of suck at. And so if Google can do it better and help you find the stuff you want, well but said. It's the actual content that you want, then there's some magic there. So
I think you're right. I worked with a cable company when I worked for my last real employer. They owned Bright House, which is in Florida and a few other markets. And I tried to come in, and my boss had me come in trying to bring kind of internet think to it. And you're right. Search was the thing. It was all about discovery and recommendation. And they just don't think that way. They just couldn't think that way.
It's impossible for me to actually find the show that I want to watch because sometimes I don't know what channel it's on, what network it's on.
I never know anymore. Yeah. We used to know that, right? No, nobody knows that anymore.
Well, the whole idea of a channel is kind of absurd.
Right.
Yeah.
Right? 500 channels. No, it's zero channels is what you want.
Well, it's really, as soon as you add the internet, it's infinite channels. So now we really got a problem.
Yeah. How do I find Twig? You know, right. That's what I would want.
Right. Well, I mean, that's where I think Google has an advantage. I think we're moving, you know, as we did in search, we moved from the categorized world that Yahoo was. Yahoo was like the cable guide to the search world that Google is. And I think the same
thing. So now go back to search and Bing. If you want to have an advantage, social will matter greatly in entertainment.
Yeah, because I want to know what Scoble's watching so I can avoid it.
Which Boxy tries to get social, right?
Yeah.
In terms of entertainment.
There's
media.
A lot of systems are trying to watch Twitter for mentions of things. I mean, during big news events. Well, last night, everybody was talking about the miners being rescued, and people were saying, "Oh, I'm crying. I love this. You know, it's interesting
it's
TV."
All over it's, Twitter,
and
yeah.
they would link to the various places you could watch it. Right, you could watch on CNN, or you could watch on Fox, or you could watch it on a weird Spanish channel on YouTube, Ustream.
But the fascinating thing, Robert, was it was all the same government. Feed.
Yeah.
And so it was exactly the same video. I watched on BBC because I couldn't stand to watch it with Larry King.
Yeah.
And the BBC correspondents are bilingual, so I got a better sense. But the fascinating thing was here, the video itself was exactly the same everywhere.
We have run out of time. I can't believe how much we've run out of time. There's so many other stories. Andy Rubin says the world doesn't need another platform. Windows Phone 7 came out this week. Very different than Android and iPhone. Very data and OS centric compared to app centric. Of course, if I'm Microsoft, I think I've lost the app war, so might as well do that. Any thoughts on Windows Phone 7?
Looks nice. No apps.
Looks nice. Pretty.
I can't believe it got good reviews. I mean, I made fun of Microsoft OS's for that for ages. And, you know, people are liking it to their surprise. So, you know, I will at least look at it. I'm not going to buy it.
I played with it. It's a very nice OS. But I have 350 apps on my iPhone. Right. And, you know, you can make fun of that. But I use a good percentage of those. And I count on them now. I can't live with a phone that doesn't have those apps. So
I rely on apps, too. Everything pretty much that I do when I'm out and about on my phone is contained in an app just because that experience is so much better. I mean, if it's as elegant as it sounds, then, you know, the hardware makers, they might embrace it. It really depends on the quality of phone that gets delivered to the consumer and if the consumer can, you know, use it and then do what it is they want to do. And maybe they, you know, want a much more limited experience than I want on my phone. But we haven't seen that happen because they have voted in favor of apps. Should be interesting, though.
You'll be able to buy a Galaxy Tab soon. This is the tablet version of Samsung's Galaxy. $649 unsubsidized, $399 with a 2-year contract, at least at T-Mobile. Verizon might also have a Tab. They look like they'll have a launch date of November 1st, Sprint on the 14th, AT&T and T-Mobile sometime in the fourth quarter.
And no Wi-Fi only coming yet.
Just 3G. Just 3G.
What do you say, Leo? You going to do it?
Oh, I'm going to buy one the minute I can. You bet.
Jennifer?
No, I'm going to pass. I mean, I think it's kind of like the iPod and the Zune. I just don't necessarily see the point.
Robert, you're buying one.
It's tough because it's not on Verizon. I need a new Verizon phone.
It's going to be on Verizon, but it's not a phone.
You can't use it as a phone.
Yeah, thanks. The reason I want a Verizon phone is so I can use it
for
as
the
a phone.
That's why I use a Droid X. If I need to make phone calls, I use a Droid X. And if I want,
I'm looking at the Droid Incredible. It's very nice phone. What's the hot Verizon phone right now? That's what I'm going to be buying.
I think a Droid X because I like the big screen. You should take a look at the Droid X before you opt for the Incredible. Incredible is very nice.
The guys who were just here had a Droid X, and it looks pretty nice. Yeah. But I don't know. That's an aside. It's on T-Mobile. T-Mobile doesn't work in my house. I can't use it.
Well, no, they said Verizon, Sprint. It's going to be in everybody. Everybody. Verizon, November 1st.
Verizon.
Yeah, Verizon,
is there a
Sprint.
On Verizon?
Yeah, Verizon, Sprint, T-Mobile, everybody, and AT&T.
Well, then I might buy one for my Verizon.
But for 3G only.
Yeah.
No phone. RIP Goog 411. I guess it did its job. It's over.
That's sad.
I know.
I'm actually pissed. I was using it.
I loved Goog 411. Now I have to go back to paying $1.75 for a listing? Give me a break. Why did they kill Goog 411?
They got what they wanted out of it. They got voice samples of the yin yang.
Yep.
And it made them smart about voice, and they are good about voice. And I guess it was costing money. I don't know why they killed it. That's what I don't get.
If you have a smartphone, you can pretty much do this, especially if you have 2.2 on an Android phone, you can pretty much do the same thing by just pressing a button saying, yeah, and it'll give it to
you. That's
true. So I guess you don't really need it anymore.
I haven't used 411 in so long. Yeah. I just use the Google Maps to look at places and phone numbers. And
do you use voice, Robert?
10% of the time, maybe 5%.
Here's a little tip, though. You can text. I didn't know this. This is from Mashable. You can text Google and the name of text the name of a location of a business to Google. They'll give you the phone number.
Yeah.
Via text. 466-453. That's what Google is. Let's see here. Real quickly, hardware acceleration won't happen until Chrome 9. I think that's pretty much all of our stories.
Yeah, I think that's the good stuff.
Let's now we don't have a tip of the week unless Gina Trapani, Jennifer, told you to come up with a tip. Did she?
She didn't, but I have my own.
Well, give us a tip.
All right. Well, I've just started using it, so I can't totally vouch for it. But Email Oracle, it's a browser add-on that works with Gmail, and so you can track the email messages that you send and kind of get some analytics on that. Really interesting.
Does it know the email before you get it?
What do you mean?
Oh, I don't know. I'm just making it up.
No, actually, like it inserts a little.
What do I mean? What do you mean? What do I mean? I mean nothing. So it's a Gmail plugin.
Well, it's actually a browser plugin that works with Gmail.
Got it.
I'm not sure if it works on, I'm sure it works on a bunch of different browsers. I'm using it on Safari, but inserts a little tracking image into your email. And then if your recipients are opening their email.
Oh, I hate that.
I know, right? I don't, as a recipient, I don't want it. Right. But as a sender, it's kind of interesting. You can set reminders. So if you haven't heard back from somebody, you know, in 3 days, you can get like a little reminder for that.
There was a website that offered this service, like who read this or something like that. So it's receipts, but it's sneaky receipts. Sneaky receipts.
It's less creepy than going into Bing and seeing Facebook likes.
Well, that's saying a lot. EmailOracle.com. Track who opens and responds to your email. Thank you, Jennifer. Jennifer is at Mashable.com. You can follow her on Twitter at Jay Bruin. Anything else you want to plug? Upcoming things you're doing?
No. I'm kind of boring. Actually, I have a couple speaking engagements next week. So
Where?
I'm doing, something at the AMAs next week, an Eloqua sponsored panel. It should be interesting, on social media and business and stuff
Perfect.
Like that.
Perfect. Our number of the week, Mr. Jeff Jarvis.
Alrighty, here we have ComScore coming out with the latest video viewing watching, and Google remains way ahead with 144.2 million unique viewers.
Wow.
Yahoo moves up to 54.4 million. Facebook at 52.2, a horse race. Microsoft coming in fourth. Hulu is in ninth place. But interestingly, Google gets 260 minutes per viewer, and Hulu gets second to that, even at ninth place, for the 163 minutes, which I guess would speak to watching real shows.
Google gets 260 minutes per viewer?
Yep.
That's per day, year, week, month?
Per month.
260 minutes a month. That's like 10 minutes a day. I guess that makes sense.
Two videos a day.
Yeah.
Three videos.
A couple of videos a day. Yeah. Fred Figglehorn. That'll take up a lot of that time. What is that all about? I know what it's about. It's about 12-year-old sense of humor. My tool of the week is in honor of our San Francisco Giants, who are going to the National League A division series to face the Phillies. I almost want to say to get beat by the Phillies, but I have hope. And I love this tool. It's really nothing new. You've probably seen it before. I might even have recommended it before, but it's just in time for postseason. It's Major League Baseball's At Bat application. There is an iPhone version of this. There's an iPad version of this, but it is on Android as well. And I was using it like crazy when I had to go out and the Giants were playing the Braves and I wanted to know what was going on. Very important, even during postseason. Now, it's not cheap. I think it's, I can't remember what it is, $19, something like that. It's expensive. But you can listen to game audio. You can watch game video with an add-on that costs even more. You can see what's happening. And, of course, you can see when the World Series happens. You'll be able to see that as well.
Leo, is there any reason to use that while you're watching the game?
Yeah. Actually, if we had a game, I guess I can go back in time because it shows pitch counts, it shows lineups, it gives you a lot of extra. You know, baseball fans are pretty darn geeky, and just the ability to see the box score as it's happening, the plays, play by play. You know, I was watching the TV and somebody said, "Who hit that home run?" And I just said, "Well, no problem. Let me go back here, bottom of the second. Oh yeah, it was Pat Burrell." You can see the field itself, but you can also see the plays as they happen. Because the game isn't going on right now, it's not showing it, but it'll show you as the pitches as they come in, and there's even little video clips that you can watch after the fact. So I have to say,
it's real hard to make a boring sport interesting, huh?
Hey! You got the Yankees. You got something to celebrate.
But I'm rooting for the Phillies. Go Phillies.
Are you? Are you from Philadelphia?
No, the Giants beat my Padres. I'm really angry.
Oh.
I was at the game. People were yelling obscenities at me.
Oh,
so,
okay. I understand.
Hate the Giants. And then my boyfriend's team is the Phillies. So.
Oh, that's fun. Well, it is going to be, it starts Saturday night. It's going to be a lot of fun. And yeah, I'll be using this to keep an eye on what's going on. I have to say, it really is a nice little application. And I think it's going to be the inspiration. I know the NBA is doing something similar for Google TV. It's going to end up being the inspiration for, oh, now I've really got copyright. Now I've got Major League Baseball on my ass.
Oh, they're coming to get you.
Oh, now I'm in deep trouble. This will never show up on YouTube. Oh my God, what have I done? So that was a news story. Man. It's fair use, Major League Baseball. I'm showing off your damn application. Give me a break. Robert Scoble works at Rackspace, where he interviews some of the most interesting people in the business, not just of cloud computing, but all kinds of stuff. You just interviewed some really good people, you were saying, today. Who did you talk to today?
I can't tell you.
Oh!
But yesterday, the reason I have a business card in my hand is I interviewed Card Munch, which takes pictures of your business cards and sends them up to the cloud. But what they do then is they use Amazon's Mechanical Turk to send that image over to a bunch of different people who will type in the information and send it back to you. And they have an algorithm to figure out the accuracy, and they have an NDA so that, you know, your cards won't get shared supposedly with other people. But they did
iPhone
really
only.
iPhone only today. I think they're working on other platforms shortly.
Card Munch.
Yeah.
Yeah, I use a card scan app on the iPhone that is mechanical, and it would be so much better.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to check it out.
Worked pretty good. The cards come back to you in 10 minutes to an hour, wow. Something like that.
Scobalizer.com. Jeff Jarvis teaches journalism to a bunch of kids who are wet behind the ears, but soon will be taking over this industry. So
entrepreneurs.
Honor him. He's also a blogger at BuzzMachine.com and the author of a fantastic book that we know as WWGD, What the Hell Would Google Do? Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. And Jennifer, thank you for your first time. Really appreciate it. I know it's always a little scary to get on with people of the likes of Scoble and Jarvis.
I had fun. I wasn't scared. You guys are nothing.
I'm scared. Jennifer, thank you so much for being here. She writes for Mashable.com. Follow her on Twitter, at Jay Bruin. Thank you all for being here. We do this show every Wednesday afternoon at 1 p.m. Pacific time, 4 p.m. Eastern, for now until daylight savings time, summertime in the U.S. That is 2000 UTC at live.twit.tv. We invite you to tune in. And if you are watching live, join our chat room at irc.twit.tv in the Pound Twit Live room. A reminder, once again, Steve Wozniak coming up. We're going to interview him right after Tech News today. That should be a lot of fun, and we will make that a Twit special, so you'll be able to download that later. Twit.tv/Twig for all the Twig shows, both audio and video. And for the Woz interview, it's twit.tv/specials. I'm Leo Laporte. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on This Week in Google.